Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting guest, you know, a guest that has been involved in six different startups. Obviously, he's founded three of them, and he's gone through the whole cycle, building, scaling, financing, and all of that stuff. We're going to be talking about how to manage hypergrowth, especially in a market that is early versus, let's say, a market that is not as early. Also, the difference, when you're thinking about like really building something before it is really time, when it's kind of like early, and then also transitioning from a big corporation to perhaps, you know, venturing to the startup world. So, very exciting conversation ahead. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Chris Blissner. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So originally born and raised in Washington State, give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Good. You know, there's not a whole lot of net new technology businesses happening here on the eastern side of Washington State. So after college, I moved to the Seattle area, did a couple of startups over there and worked at Microsoft. Really wanted to scratch that technology itch. I studied computer science in school, and so, but took more of a less of a physics side of computer science and more of a business management side of computer science. So, was interested in business and accounting and those kinds of things, but also technology and software development. So, it was a great opportunity. Seattle's a fantastic market for that stuff. So, shortly after college, moved over and had a great start to my career there.
So, obviously, you know, like your career, you know, has been really incredible. I mean, you've done startups, you've done corporations, but in this case, you know, for you, you know, you got into the whole startup world via Shop the Globe. So how was that, you know, experience of venturing into the world of smaller companies?
You know, I think when you're young, you're probably more open to taking risks, probably because you just don't know any better. But I think for me, startups always are fun to work at. But when I was at Microsoft as a consultant, contractor, they offered me a full-time job. It wasn't what I was thinking. It was in the sort of an IT group that I wasn't super fond of at the time. And so I thought, okay, maybe there's something better out here. And I looked around and I found this job at Shop the Globe. It was a company that was just being bought by theglobe.com out of New York during the hype cycle of the late 90s. And so a lot was going on. There's a buzz in the office, a lot of excitement. A lot of new tech being created on the fly. And so it just felt like a much more interesting place as a young person who was doing, working on software development to say, wow, I can break barriers here. I can work on new things that nobody else is doing. And there's a lot of great opportunity here. And so I think that was a lot of the excitement of trying out startups for the very first time at Shop the Globe was an amazing experience. And I still have lifelong friends from there today. And several of them are CEOs, actually. Of other very successful startup businesses. So I think it sort of ignited a passion inside of a bunch of us, for sure.
And also, what was that journey like to go from like more like the business development or corporate development to like the CTO? I mean, you've transitioned quite a bit. And I know that going from the business side to the technical side and vice versa is not an easy transition. So how was that for you?
Yeah, you know, I realized that in order to effectively manage technology, you've got to try different positions. So I think it's really hard if you don't try out an engineering position or a testing position or a project management position, because it's hard to manage those folks. You don't know what you haven't walked a mile in their shoes, as they say. And so early on, I job hopped around a bit to get some of those experiences so I could see what I wanted to do. And I realized I definitely wanted to manage technology. And so that sort of grew into the technology management side. And once I was there, I realized, wow, a lot of the things that you do with a technology management career, you could do as a CEO of a technology firm. And so there was some nice overlap there. You manage a budget, you manage a P&L, you do all those kinds of things. And so for me, it was just a natural sort of thing to say, hey, listen, I love and love working with people, love working with technology, love building new things. There's a great way to sort of combine all those things together in the CEO role of a technology startup.
So then for you, you know, like when you ended up going into the startup world, and you did that actually the first time around was with Parking Eye. How was that for you? Because you guys were a little bit ahead of time.
Yes. Yeah, it was an interesting time. Again, ParkingEye was a technology we developed to automate parking lot attendant stuff. So back in the day, I'll probably date myself with the younger folks, but back in the day, you'd shove dollar bills in a slot somewhere and somebody would come along and collect them at some point. It was a cash-based business. And before, you know, pay stations were a thing, before automated sort of a lot of tenants were a thing. And so we developed a technology that had a camera associated with it, integrated with the pay station, and was really, really helpful to sort of cut labor out of the system and really cutting edge. But the reality was that was an industry that was wrought with folks that had zero interest in technology. They were doing just fine by collecting cash and doing the business that way. And so they weren't really motivated to go out and buy these pay stations and to buy the cameras. It was great technology that sort of didn't have the market ready to buy it. And so we ended up actually selling that tech to a firm in the UK who went bananas with it. That business, I think, grew over 100 million in enterprise value. And a lot because the market there was ready for it, right? They were already doing license plate recognition technology. And so the concept of having automated pay stations was easy for them to get their brain around, whereas the market in the US was still, I think, a decade too early.
And how is it like, you know, for you, like, obviously this experience going through the full cycle, being able to do also a transaction, I'm sure that gave you more visibility into the whole thing, you know, going from first base all the way to hitting the home run.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, the thing with ParkingEye is it never really became a huge business for us in the U.S. So it was kind of a small deal for us. But I think what was interesting was just working through the concept of going from an idea all the way through to production deployments and bringing in revenue from customers, all the things that are critical to building a business. Having seen that and done it from a founder perspective was really eye-opening, because when you're working at big businesses, when you're working at Microsoft or when you're working somewhere else, you don't have that experience. You don't realize how much goes into taking an idea from concept all the way to reality and invoicing the customer and getting that done. And there's a lot there. And that's why a lot of businesses struggle to get off the ground, is because there's an art in terms of how you launch product, how do you find customers, how do you get them to pay for what it is you're building, how you partner with them, all those kind of things.
So then for you, right after this, I mean, you go into like a journey of having your own consulting. You know, you also ended up working at Microsoft. You know, so how do you go from, you know, ultimately experiencing startups to going to like a larger corporation? I mean, that's quite the shift.
Yeah, it is. And I would say it's probably more driven by family and personal needs at the time. We started to build a family, have a couple of kids. And so at that point, you know, you realize you want a little bit more stability in your life, because if startups can be rough, right? You don't know where your next paycheck is coming. And, you know, if you don't hit something groundbreaking and things take off like a rocket ship, which doesn't always happen, there's a lot of ups and downs, and that can be tough when you're trying to put food on the table for your family. And so for me, having done that for a number of years, I really wanted to experience something a little more stable for a little while. And I knew I had a lot of capabilities that I could bring to the table for a firm like Microsoft. And so I really enjoyed my time there and had some fantastic opportunities, thanks to the groups that I worked with, the teams I worked with, and my managers there. But I think at the end of the day, it was another life decision that sort of drove me to move back to Spokane and take another job outside of Microsoft. But for me, it was a great learning curve. You know, they do their own things. They're a factory in terms of developing software. And so I was able to see software development from a large company perspective, which was great. So understanding how enterprises think about things, how that whole process works, and developed and helped launch some really big products there, was part of the SharePoint 2007 chip cycle and some other products there as well. And so that was a great experience for me to just go through. And I think everybody who's thinking about technology or thinking about software, going through a ship cycle is important, whether it's at a startup, whether it's at a big corporation. And obviously the ship cycles at big corporations are longer, so it takes a little while to get through. But seeing it from end to end is something that's super important, because that way you can understand, you know, what happens in the beginning, what happens in the middle, what happens at the end, and how it's all related. That certainly helped set the stage for me to actually go out and build software for a living.
So at what point do you realize that maybe it's time to go at it again with Second Watch?
You know, it was funny. We had built this interesting business with ambassadors. It was student travel, educational student travel. So you could get college credit for sending your junior high and high school kids overseas. It was a great business, doing really well. And we started to play with the concept of cloud. So this was probably 2007, 2008, Amazon had, I think at the time, three services, EC2, S3, and I think Simple Queue service at the time or whatever it was. And so we thought, wow, we do these marketing campaigns once a year. They're 3 months long. They're super intense, but then we're done. And the computing power is just sitting there. Like, we had this huge data center we built, and we had a secondary data center in Seattle for backup. And it just felt odd that we had to have this gear sitting there 9 months of the year and not using it. And so the cloud came out. We're like, oh, wow, you can pay by the hour and then you can give it back and you don't have to pay for it anymore. There's some interesting ideas here. And so, and it leveraged Amazon's global footprint. And so we started experimenting within ambassadors around how we did that. It worked so well for some of the workloads we did that I built a business plan for how could we get away with not having any infrastructure running in a data center. Because as a small company, if you're not a technology company, running a data center is really, really painful. You've got to have a lot of specialty skill sets. You're working with 20 or 30 different vendors. Well, all those vendors collapse into one or two vendors, right? You're getting all your stuff from Amazon now, where you used to buy from HP, EMC, Dell, Cisco, all these F5, all these other vendors. You're getting all that stuff now from one vendor. It was like, wow, this is a shift in the technology landscape, very akin to mainframe and client server. This cloud thing is a really, really big deal. And so for me, I wanted to experience more of that, but I realized that it was more than just one company. I didn't want to just do it once with ambassadors. I wanted to do it all over the place. And so we set out, we looked in the market and said, okay, what's out there? Well, Amazon said, if you needed help, you could go look at the forums, send us an email, and then maybe we'd get back to you. They really didn't have a customer support desk or any of those kinds of things at the time. And so we thought, wow, what a great business we could set up to help companies figure this stuff out, because we've done the math. It's much, much cheaper for non-technical businesses to have their data centers run in Amazon and all that gear running in Amazon, because the reality is you don't need to run it 24/7. Nobody does, right? All your stuff is dynamic, but the dynamic model doesn't exist on-prem. It exists only in public cloud. And so that business model change is what spurred everyone to move stuff in. So we formed Second Watch, and we quickly became Amazon Web Services' go-to partner. And we did some of the largest data center migrations into public cloud that have ever been done, from brands like Coca-Cola, Nike, Starbucks, Toyota, Adobe, Thomson Reuters. You name the large brands, we moved their data centers from on-prem into AWS at the time, and then eventually Microsoft and Google when they started to catch up. But it was a really nice experience to sort of see this business idea of a market that was, super early. So, again, we did some of the very first data center migrations. We did the first worldwide data center migration, where we had a data center in the US, one in Sydney, and one in Europe. And we moved them all at the same time into the cloud. And so those kind of concepts didn't exist before. And so having gone through that, that was a really unique experience.
So in this case, I mean, you guys raised some money too. I mean, how much money did the company raise throughout its life? And what was that journey like too of raising the money?
Yeah, so I raised about $40 million myself across three different firms. So we started with Madrona. You always start with friends and family. So we certainly did that. But prior to this, we really hadn't had a big win yet. So the friends and family stuff wasn't huge for us. And so we moved quickly to an institutional investor. So that was Madrona Capital out of Seattle. They were great to work with. And then we closed a growth round with Columbia Capital out of Washington, D.C. And then the last round I closed was with Top Tier Capital out of San Francisco. All great firms to work with, did a great job supporting us. We sort of migrated the business from kind of a technology company in general to more of a professional services, managed services business. That's not my background. I'm more of a software guy. So we brought in a CEO to run the business, and he ended up raising probably another 20 or 30 million. I don't know what the total was because I left in 2017. But it was a great opportunity to see this market evolve, right? So all this massive stuff back in 2008, there was very little run on Amazon. The market for cloud computing didn't exist, and I don't even think Gartner had a magic quadrant at that point. To where we are today, where Amazon's $100 billion run rate business from just the AWS portion alone, that's a massive swing from where it was even a decade ago. And so just to have been a part of that was really awesome.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. There's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone, is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And what was it like to manage the growth, you know, especially, you know, during the early days, and what would that transition look like from early stage to growth stage too?
Yeah, it was hard in that it was my first deal. And I remember having that conversation with Columbia because they'd asked me specifically, had you been a CEO of a growth firm before? And I said, no, I've been a CEO before, but not of a growth firm and something that had grown this fast and in a market like this. And so there was a lot of learning, and that can be painful. We definitely had our ups and downs. Being more focused on the migrations, because that's what the customers were looking for, it allowed us to have a lot of revenue come in the door quickly, but it was also a challenge to sort of staff, because you had to have people to actually deliver the services. And we had customers, you know, big banks or other folks that were doing big moves that wanted to use every single person that we had on staff. And we're like, okay, that doesn't feel good for me. Like, we need other customers. And so, you know, just trying to manage that that growth piece, both on the customer side and the employee side, was a bit tricky early on. But I think we finally figured it out, and it's still a great business. They're doing well. I think they've rebranded themselves. But that was a really fun experience, and I left that company. So started with from an idea and really just a couple of co-founders, and then grew it to 250 plus employees.
So what trigger there for you to want to make a move and get going with Vega? Because, I mean, obviously, once you've built a company like that and you've raised all that money, you know, turning pages is not that easy.
No, it's not. And so a couple of things needed to happen. One, we wanted to do some secondaries so we could get, because we weren't in the place where we wanted to sell the entire business yet. Still growing. And so we did a couple of secondary transactions to get the early guys out. They did really well. Depending on what time you got out, the early guys got 7x or 11x on their return. So that was nice. And then they eventually sold the business to ST Telemedia. That was after I left the business. But I think for me, it sort of had shifted into this kind of consulting managed services environment, which is all about billable hours and those kinds of things. And I'd done a little bit of that in my career, but wasn't a huge fan of it, because it's a really hard business to be a part of, right? You sort of have to go find your business every single year. It's not recurring. The managed services side can be, but that, again, those contracts are tough to get. And so it was just felt like it wasn't the core of what I enjoyed doing, which was really software development. We had done a little bit of software development early on with Second Watch, but when we got big enough, we realized that the team of a dozen folks we had working on it just wasn't enough to compete with folks that were doing it for a living. And so we jettisoned that and bought a competitor, Cloud Health Technologies out of Boston. We used their software to run our business on. And I realized, boy, there's still some huge gaps here. There's huge gaps in the operational side of it, just in the functional side of optimization. And so we thought, wow, what a market opportunity now that the market has matured. And these guys have been in business for 10 years, and they're not addressing the gaps. Why don't we create Vega as a way to address these market gaps that exist today?
So then Vega, give us a walkthrough there through how you guys ended up putting together the business model and how you guys are making money.
Yeah, so Vega was really designed around the idea that the market was stuck in this reporting bucket, right? So cloud observability, cloud health, cloud ability, cloud checker were built from the get-go, before multi-cloud was the thing, before scale cloud was the thing, really built as an observability tool to help you understand your bill and where costs were going, and maybe do a little bit of recommendations, but they weren't great. And at the end of the day, people weren't, it was noise. People weren't doing what they needed to get done because there wasn't automation to go get the work done. So it was sort of like your car's broke, you take it to the mechanic and you say, hey, I need your help. And the mechanic says, well, here's the parts you need, but I don't have them and I can't fix it for you. Well, that's a pretty frustrating conversation to have over and over with customers. And that was sort of where the industry was prior to Vega. And so we really wanted to bridge that gap between reporting and operations, right? And so that was the real big aha moment for us was, how do we bring our capabilities, having run a managed service provider, which is all about operations, how do we bring that capability from a decade of doing that and combine that with the reporting capabilities that we also had early on, and build out this platform designed from the ground up as multi-cloud, scale, large enterprise, to be able to do these things, right? So that I can not only tell you where you're spending and how to fix it, but I can actually help you fix it, right? I can bring that automation forward. And today, if you're going to do what Vega does, you're going to have to buy a half dozen or more tools. And that's frustrating as a CIO, right? Now I'm paying six different vendors, so my costs have gone up. If I'm a managed service provider, my margins have gone down because now my COGS are much bigger. Like it's a frustrating experience. It's very much akin to the security landscape, honestly. And I think why you see Palo Alto and a lot of those companies buying more and more and trying to become a platform, because CIOs and CISOs are frustrated because they're having to buy 20 different tools to protect their environment and do something that's important for the organization. But now I got to integrate those tools and figure it all out. They want to avoid that on the cloud optimization side. So Vega is a platform that they can purchase. They don't have to go buy another six tools. And so it's a way for us to retire a lot of that stuff and be able to have a platform play. That felt like the right business model for us. And it's shown itself in our customer base.
And you guys have raised about $11 million. So what did you do differently this time around when it came to getting external money?
Yeah, you know, for us, friends and family this time around was a lot easier to get because and a lot broader because we'd done so well with Second Watch. So this is a second business in the same market. I think, you know, repeatability and people that have experience means a lot. It means a lot to investors, means a lot to customers. It means that you're not starting from scratch. You're not going to run into the same roadblocks. You know this market. You know cloud. We have a lot of expertise around the table. I think over 100 years on the executive team alone of cloud when you add it all up. And so from our perspective, you know, being able to bring that to the table meant we were starting from a place of power, not a place of weakness. And so for us, that made it a lot easier to raise dollars. We have raised more than half of that $11 million has been friends and family. So in that sort of bucket, right, of sort of angel, which is great. So I think that's a great ecosystem to raise from. We continue to do some of that when we have the opportunity to. And then we brought in our first institutional investor, Album Venture Capital, in 2022. They did our seed round. They've been great to work with. Again, just focused in on B2B SaaS. So the other lesson I learned sort of going through this as an entrepreneur is that the VC community as a whole is full of folks that are interested in lots of different things. So people will look at it from a broad market perspective and say, hey, listen, we just invest in geographical areas like the Bay Area or Seattle or whatever it might be. Or we focus on a particular niche, right? Software, consumer, healthcare tech, whatever it might be. And in my experience, the folks that have a niche tend to provide more value because they have pattern recognition, right? So you look, your portfolio companies look a lot alike. They can share. So when you sit down and you meet with other CEOs, you're meeting with other B2B SaaS CEOs and not, you know, the CEO of a dog walking service. Like that's not going to help, right? And so I think that's the difference when you look at sort of finding specialized investors versus non-specialized early stage, because those are the times when you actually need some advice. You don't want those folks running it. I never build a board or a company for the investor to the board to run it, but they can provide advice and really be helpful. And the ability for them to do that is much more focused because all their portfolio companies are B2B SaaS. So it allows us to have some commonality around it.
So then in this case for you guys, you know, vision is a big one to secure money, get everyone involved, employees. I mean, you guys have like about 50 employees now. If you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world, Chris, where the vision of Vega is fully realized, what does that world look like?
You know, I think this market, so the market today is about $400 billion. I think it's going to $1 trillion, the market that we service, infrastructure and platform as a service, in the next 7 years. It's tremendous. I think there's a $1 billion opportunity here for us. I think that we can grow this company as large as we want to grow it, either by ourselves or with a partner. I think there's a lot of opportunity. We're seeing that across the board in our pipeline and the customers we're bringing in. The industry as a whole is frustrated. They're overpaying, right? There's a lot of waste in the system. We save our customers 25% on average. That's even when we displace competitors. And so that means you're not getting the value out of the competitor. And also you're still wasting money. And again, when you're spending millions of dollars a month on public cloud and we can save you 25%, it's a real sticky environment, right? And so I think there's a lot of opportunity here.
So obviously, you know, here we're talking about the future, but I want to talk about the past with a lens of reflection. If I put you into a time machine, Chris, and I bring you to that moment where you were thinking about starting something of your own, and let's say you had in the early 2000s and you had the opportunity of, let's say, have a chat with your younger self, what would that be, that business, you know, piece of advice that you would be sharing before launching a business? What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah, I think a couple things. One, revenue is king. And so customers and paying revenue is king. And so focusing more on that versus raising money. I think a lot of folks jump to, hey, I can find an investor who's interested in my idea, and then we'll figure out how to build a business after that. That's a hard road to hoe. I think from my experience, you want to have part of product market fit is finding customers that are willing to part with their partner dollars and pay for your solution that does something for them, right? And so that mathematical formula that has to happen there is really tough to get, right? Because you have to have a business need. You can't just have an idea searching for a business need, right? Like you've got to solve a core problem. And I think the businesses that do really well recognize that. They're customer focused. They partner early on with their customers, and they bring them along on the journey. So because the risk that you have is that you tend to focus on something shiny, right? Like you're doing some cool tech, and tech is always in this bucket, right? Of, hey, it looks awesome. This is really cool. Why aren't people paying for it? Well, maybe you're too early. Maybe there's not a market for that. Maybe the solution that exists is good enough, right? There's a lot of reasons why businesses won't work. And I think from my experience, I would love to just go back and say, hey, listen, focus on customers and revenue. But solving those problems, you will always have a business. And then you can decide how big the business is, right? So whether it's a venture scale business or whether it's, you know, a lifestyle business, whatever. But you need to start with this problem, customers first.
I love it. So Chris, for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
You can hit me out on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. That's a great way to connect. That way we can share on that way. And I try and answer those messages once a week or once every couple of weeks. I'm a little bit busy, but that's an easy way. That's probably the easiest way, honestly, to get a hold of me.
Well, hey, easy enough. Well, Chris, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us today.
Thanks, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.